Introduction and James chapter 1 verses 1 through 4. The first talk in a series on the book of James was presented by Rusty Rexius on April 25, 2016 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2016. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Personally, and this ultimately will relate to this letter, missive that we're going to read, I've spent my entire working life doing one of two things. I had a little business of my own up in Portland. I actually had a snow ski and water ski shop, and I ended up selling boats up there. I did that for a few years, and then 30 years or so ago, I came back, and I've been helping to run our family business since that time. So that's what I do every day. I'm in the business community, as they say, making business decisions, as they also say. I've spent most of my life also trying to figure out what I believe and why. And I've had good fortune in the midst of my business world to sort of integrate this pursuit of what is true and right and real as it's related to my business interactions. In other words, I've spent all of my life trying to figure out how what I believe fits with what I actually do every day. And I mean, all of you do that to some extent. But for me, when I get to this particular study in James, a number of the things that James decides to talk about are things that I think about on a daily basis at work and in what I do in the business community. So in some respects, this seems very nuts and bolts to me, very down to earth, very rubber meets the road sort of stuff. I'll talk about that in just a minute. Things like money, honoring certain people over others, disparaging others, making oaths or promises and then not keeping them. They all find their ways into my everyday life and they find their way into this letter. So I find this incredibly instructive for me. At a very personal level, I've spent most of my life around here. I've been taught by all the same people that you have been taught by. That's been incredibly instructive, informative. It's been transformational for me. My perspective is probably not anything that you haven't already heard. I don't really think that, generally speaking, the sort of overarching belief I have about God and me and the way that all works together is probably very different than what you've ever heard before. So whether that's good or bad, I don't know. I sort of fall into the Reformation party line for whatever that's worth. So I just bring that up just for nothing more than to bring it up. I do, however, have a slightly different twist, and that I mentioned it a minute ago. One, I've always been obsessed, and you know this from the last time I spoke here, with the whole Jewish thing. I don't know why. I don't know where that came from. I don't even know when it started. But I have been obsessed with the people of Israel, the nation of Israel, the biblical story of the Jews. And some time ago, that obsession became somewhat of a bit of a reality as Susie and I began to talk about what that would mean in our faith. And we've been to Israel a couple of times. We're going again. And then, as you most of you know, in the process of the thinking through the strategy at Gutenberg College, we interacted with the Messianic community, which I had never done before. That has been incredibly instructive, incredibly informative. It has, I don't think it's radically changed what I think, but it has altered my perspective some. It has made me more convinced that understanding Jewish thought, whether it's Old or New Testament, is absolutely imperative. You can't do without it. We'll never understand our Bibles if we don't understand how a Jewish person would be thinking about what was written, because it was written by a Jewish person to Jewish people in Jewish times, in a Jewish world, with Jewish things going on. So I have that bent. I can't help it. I don't know how else to do it now. So every time I'm thinking about this stuff, that's the lens through which I am thinking, through a Jewish lens, as a Gentile believer. I say this, I'll probably say it a couple of times while I'm standing here. I'm joking about it at some level, but at another level, I'm not joking about it at all. I actually think I'm Jewish. I won't bore you with the details, but there is some evidence that our family might be. That evidence is slim. I don't think we'll ever know, and in some respects, I hope I don't, because I'll never have to say, gee, I'm not after all. So I'm just going to tell you I am, and I'm going to believe that. I will tell you a very quick story, and I'll embarrass him because he's here, but I'm going to tell it anyway. We were at a family function, And my aunt, who I don't really actually know very well at all, for some odd reason saw a bunch of us stand. It was a wedding, actually. We were standing together. And my aunt, who's actually been a preacher her whole life, she made a comment to her son or daughter-in-law. But anyway, she just out of nowhere said, "They're Jewish. Our family's Jewish." So she went on this bit of a research to figure out whether we were or we not, or we aren't. And it came to a dead end with a big question mark. There was a real possibility that we were, but no way to know for sure. And that's kind of where it stopped. I've done a little more research. I'm convinced we are. But anyway, that's not the story. I went home. My boys were up for dinner, I think it was, and I said something. "I have an announcement to make." I didn't even get the words out of my mouth. And Trevor, who's here, raises his arms and he says, "We're Jewish!" Yes! So if nothing else, me and Trev were Jewish. I don't know about the rest of my family, but Trevor and I were Jewish. But I actually do think I am. And in some respects, I know that has an impact on how I think about things and how I'm even studying and working through some of the work that I do in biblical study. So I'll say it, I'm sure, a couple of times. You know where that's coming from now. So I think those are my opening remarks, as it were. At another place where I used to go on Sundays, I would do this somewhat frequently. I haven't done it since then. That didn't really go so well, as it turned out, there. So in some respects, I'm very hesitant in this. I know God has given me, I don't know if he's given me a gift, but he's certainly given me a desire to know what's true and a certain set of tools to figure some of that out. I think part of what I'm supposed to do with that is share that information. But that has been trouble for me in some respects. And so there's some sense of hesitancy and reluctance. It's like, I love to do this, but I kind of know where this goes. So I'm not nervous. I'm a little sheepish, I guess you would say. So I put that out there so you know a little bit about where I'm coming from. I will tell you this, what I intend to do and how I intend to do it, what I intend to say, will feel much more like a Bible study than it will a sermon. I don't really do sermons. I mean, I've got a couple in my pocket now and then for when I need them. But honestly, this is way more to me like a Bible study. And I hope that's comfortable. I hope that's helpful. That's absolutely what this is going to feel like, much more so than me pontificating on what it is I think is going on. Last but not least, my mother, who maybe will listen to this, I don't know, but she is my greatest fan and my greatest critic, for sure. And whenever I say things that are sort of theologically based or biblically bound, she'll look at me, and not so much anymore, but it used to be she would say, "Well, then how then shall we live?" And her point was, well, it's fine to know all this stuff, but how do you actually live? And in her world, which many of you know her, she's a counselor and has been for as long as I can remember, and she's dealing with where people live, and it's never good, never good. And so her question back to me with all of my knowledge and conclusions is, fine, how do we live? I used to really be irritated at that. I'm still a little irritated by it, but I hope I've matured a little bit. It's a legitimate question. It's a very legitimate question. And the beauty of this book that we're going to look at together, James, I think is very much an answer to the question, how do we live? In a very different context than my mother is asking it, but still the same question. How do we live? And James, or somebody who is talking about James, is answering that question. Okay, some general thoughts about James. Just an overview, I guess. For some odd reason, his name is James in our English Bibles, but his real name was Jacob. There's a, I don't know if you could count them, there's a whole bunch of stories about how it got from Jacob to James, and none of them seem very compelling to me. I don't know. I just know now it's James, and that's what I'm going to go with. If we were speaking with our Hebrew hats on, we would say Yaakov. We wouldn't say James. One of the things that I should have mentioned before I even said that, this was a quote that I got in by a rabbi that I have read. I think this is pertinent to this book. He says that Jewish teaching is such that you don't bore them too long on one subject. He often referred to the Jewish way of teaching as a string of pearls, where you're just talking about something, and then you go to the next thing, and then to the next thing, and then to the next thing, which is very much how James feels. It is most likely that this book of James was written by James, the brother of Jesus. I'm going to talk a little bit about the options. Ultimately, I'm going to argue or assert that it was James, the brother of Jesus, who wrote it. Matthew 13, I've got a number of scriptures that I will read. No reason to necessarily look at them. These are just sort of proof texts, if you will, for some of the things that I'm going to say. Matthew 13:55 says, "Isn't this the carpenter's son?" Speaking to Jesus. "Isn't his mother named Mary? And are his brothers James, Simon, and Judas, and Joseph?" Now, that doesn't prove anything. It just tells us that James is a brother of Jesus. There are options, four of them at least. There's another James, the brother of John, the one we know all very well, the apostle and the disciple. Can't really be that one because he was martyred, arguably martyred, before this book was written. Probably not James, the brother of John. He was martyred in 44 AD, by the way, and the book of James was probably written around 60, somewhere in that neighborhood. There's a second James that this could be, James, the son of Alphaeus, who also happens to be the brother of Matthew, also known as Levi. He's an apostle, a likely candidate for a book of the Bible, but we know almost nothing about him. In fact, the only thing we know about him is, as mentioned in Matthew 10:3, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas, Matthew the tax collector, James the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus. That's kind of it. The argument is, if there's not more information about him, it's probably not likely he wrote a letter that ended up as a book in the Bible. So we toss him out. James, the father of Judas, we got zero information. He's mentioned in Luke. Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. That's it. That's the third candidate, the first being James, the brother of Jesus, the second James, the brother of John, the third, see to the fourth, James, the father of Judas. The fifth, James the Younger, he's mentioned in Mark 15. There were also women watching from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James the Younger, and Jose, and Salome. Could be that one. We know zero about him, and it's probably the case that James the Younger is actually one of those other Jameses we've already mentioned. So there's no absolute proof. There's no certainty about who it is. It's just that we end up knowing from other texts that James, the brother of Jesus, became a very big deal. And it is likely, in my opinion, that the very big deal James is probably the one that wrote the letter. Couple of questions that come up. Again, we'll get to this stuff a little bit later on. Why didn't James identify himself? Why don't we know from the letter who James is? I don't know the answer to that. My speculation is we will learn, as I just mentioned, that James was a big deal. He was a big deal in the church in Jerusalem. He was a big deal in the Christian/Jewish Christian community. We're going to get to this in a minute, what I think this actually is. This isn't actually James writing the letter, but I think in general terms, he didn't identify himself because he didn't need to. Everyone knew who he was. They all would have known that this James was James, ultimately the main guy in the church in Jerusalem. So he didn't say who he was because he didn't need to say who he was. Speculation on my part, don't know if that's true. That's what I think. That's why I think he didn't identify himself. There's a few other interesting facts about James that I think are instructive as we begin to talk a little bit about the letter. James, like his brother, was very skeptical. He was even embarrassed and angry about Jesus' claims to be the Messiah. We know this from two different places in the New Testament. One is John 7:3. So Jesus' brothers advised him, "Leave here and go to Judea, or so as your disciples may see your miracles that you are performing. For no one who seeks to make a reputation for himself does anything in secret. If you are doing these things, show yourself to the world." Parenthetically, verse 5, "For not even his own brothers believed him." The second passage out of Mark, "Now Jesus went home and a crowd gathered so that they were not able to eat. When his family heard, they went out to restrain him, for they said, he's out of his mind." I think that's important because, one, James, if it is in fact the brother of Jesus, most people think that Jesus was the oldest, James would have grown up with Jesus. James would have had firsthand knowledge of who Jesus was and the way in which he lived his life, the things that he did with respect to his mother and his father and his work and whatever they did as Jewish kids in Nazareth when they were growing up. And for whatever reason, he was not convinced that his brother was the Messiah, that he would have known from his own biblical training and Torah that they were all waiting for. He didn't think that that was him. He says he didn't think it was him, as neither did his brothers. But a while later, he does decide it was him. We find out in Acts chapter 1, Verse 13, when they had entered Jerusalem, they went to the upstairs room where they were staying, Peter and John and James, that is the brother of John, and Andrew, Philip and Thomas, Bartholomew and Matthew, James the son of Alphaeus and Simon the Zealot, and Judas the son of James was there. All these continued together in prayer with one mind, together with the women, along with Mary, the mother of Jesus, and his brothers. So somewhere along the way from we think he's crazy, and they were mocking him about not going into Jerusalem with his disciples and proving who he was, after the crucifixion and the resurrection, there his brothers were with the apostles waiting for his words and his return. There is some reason why between you're crazy, Jesus, and he's alive, that there was some reason to believe he was the Messiah that he claimed to be. I think that matters. I think from our perspective, as we're thinking about how it is that we decide whether or not this Jesus is the Messiah that he claims to be, it's instructive to go and listen to the guy who was closest to it, closer than anybody arguably, who decided for himself Jesus was the Messiah that he claimed to be. Doesn't prove it, but I think it's instructive and I think it's helpful. Another note, James was not one of the original 12, but he was considered to be an apostle. You have to do a little bit of inductive or deductive. I can never get those straight. You have to do some reasoning to get there. Galatians 1:19 says, but I saw none of the other apostles. Notice it says, I saw none of the other apostles except James, the Lord's brother. So in this particular case, Paul, who speaks about the other apostles, believes that James is an apostle because he speaks of them as one of them. I didn't see them, but I saw James. 1 Corinthians 15:5, Paul also talking. And that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12, then he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. Now again, that doesn't prove that James was an apostle, but the way that is worded, it sounds like he appeared to James and then the rest of the apostles, as though James was one of the apostles. Not the original 12, but considered to be an apostle. I noted here that by an apostle by virtue of Jesus appearing to him / the selection of a new apostle, this is not about James, but had James been one of the candidates for the new apostle, the one that replaced Judas, he would have qualified, and he would have qualified on this basis. Thus, the one of the men who have accompanied us during all the time the Lord Jesus associated with us, beginning from his baptism by John until the day he was taken up from us, one of these must become a witness at the resurrection together with us. James certainly would have met those qualifications. Here's a few facts that we end up knowing for sure about James. He was the undisputed leader of the church in Jerusalem. We know that from Paul's comments, mostly from Galatians, a little bit from Acts as well. I'll read those just so that they're in the record. When James, Cephas, and John, so James, that's this brother of Jesus, James, who had a reputation as pillars, recognized the grace that had been given to me, Paul, they gave to Barnabas and me the right hand of fellowship, agreeing that we would go to the Gentiles and they would be circumcised. Acts 12:17, he motioned to them with his hand to be quiet, and then they related how the Lord had brought him out of prison. He said, tell James, this is Peter, tell James and the brothers these things, and then he left and he went to another place. Peter talking about James speaking to, go tell James, the guy who matters in Jerusalem, the head of the Jerusalem church. Tell him what's going on because it's important that he know. Acts 21:18, the next day Paul went in with us to see James and all the other elders were there. All the other elders, James was one of them. There's a ton of evidence, and I won't go through all of it, that suggests that this particular James, the brother of Jesus, was in fact the leader of the Jerusalem church. He had reason to speak and he had reason to be heard as the leader of the Jerusalem church, which again makes it a fairly compelling case for him to write a letter or have someone write it for him. A few other notes about James. It mattered to be the brother of James. If you read in Jude 1:1, who, by the way, Jude probably also is a brother of Jesus and brother of James as well. Jude says, verse 1, from Jude, a slave of Jesus Christ and brother of James, to those who were called, wrapped in blah, blah, blah. Jude thinks it's important to note that he's a brother of James. In other words, it mattered to be a brother of James. James is a big deal. There's some interesting historical I don't know if they're facts or lore. James was an extremely pious man. Everybody writes about that. Josephus writes about it. There were a few other historians that wrote about it. He's said to have had the knees of camels, or of a camel, from his constant time and his knees on prayer. That comes from a reputation and a history of supposedly spending long and every day praying in the temple. There is actually a belief, I'm not sure what I think about this, well, I know what I think about it, that James might have become or been elected to be the high priest in Jerusalem due to the corruption of the existing priesthood. We know that the priesthood was corrupt. That's undeniable. We don't know that James was elected as the high priest. That seems pretty unlikely to me for two reasons. We're going to find out that James took Torah really seriously. And in spite of the fact that he would have known that the priesthood was corrupt with respect to how it was to have functioned relative to Torah, I'd be surprised if he saw himself as qualified to be a priest in the temple, not being from the family of Levi. So that seems pretty unlikely to me, although in the Messianic world, they actually accept that to some, not with authority, but they think that that's possible. I'm not sure about that. James was written before Paul's letters. I think that's somewhat important when we get to this debate that we have between faith and works. James was writing before he would have ever even have known about or read anything that Paul said with respect to faith. James is speaking to how then shall we live? What happens in this argument of the authenticity of the Bible and the debates about the objections people have as one against the other, this is one of the things that is oftentimes elevated. You have a Bible that is in total disagreement with each other with respect to faith and works. James, on the one hand, is arguing that it is works that save you. Paul, on the other hand, is arguing that it is faith that saves you. Look at that. They can't even agree within their own Bible. None of this can be true. Well, we'll get to that argument later on, but I think it's just helpful to know from a timing standpoint, James is writing before anything that Paul would have been said would have been really known to him, certainly before he would have ever read it. The letter was written somewhere, I mentioned this before, around or just before 60 AD, just to put that in perspective of what was going on at the time. Claudius' expulsion of the Jews from Rome was around 41 or to 53 AD, so you get a sense of timing here. What was going on in the world, among other things, belief in Jesus was beginning to wane. That seems to be clear. Heretical teaching was popping up all over the place. The world was beginning to recognize the church as a dangerous rival. Within 18 months of writing the letter, James was martyred, 61 AD, somewhere in there. It's an interesting story. Again, I don't know how much of this is actually true. We know he was martyred, and we know he was martyred by the priest. Well, yes, by the priest, but it was in between procurators, Festus, and I'm not ever sure how to say this, Albinius. So there was a procurator of Rome. He died. The next one was coming along. In between times, the high priest, who was upset with James, that's interesting to me. Why was he upset with James? He certainly was upset with James, arguably, because James didn't agree with the way that this particular high priest was running the show. He was also probably upset with James because he was a believer in Jesus as Messiah, and everybody was upset with that. He was probably also challenging this particular high priest as to how he was running the show, and it was a threat to the high priest and his position. So in between the two leaders, Roman-appointed leaders, the high priest took it upon himself to kill James, get him out of the way. The story goes that they took him to the pinnacle of the temple, sound familiar? And threw him off the temple, hoping to kill him. The story goes, he hit, and for those of you who have actually been there, you know why that's a big deal. It's a long ways up there. Nobody survives that fall. But the story goes, he did survive that fall. He didn't die when he hit. When he hit, here came the Sanhedrin, probably. I mean, it was more than just the high priest. And as they realize that he's not dead yet, not to be confused with the Monty Python and the Holy Grail, not dead yet. Few of you know that. Why that's funny. Some of you don't. You're not dead yet. Sorry, couldn't help myself. They start to pick up stones to finish him off. And the story goes, James says, "Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do." Quoting Jesus, of course. And then they killed him. And we do know that he died, and he died a martyr's death, and he died the martyr's death at the hands of the high priest. So that, there's little argument. The rest of that, I don't know. But they did stone him, it appears, and he died. Last note about the community of believers at the time, the believing community was having trouble and was being tempted, as they say, to stay inside, to basically be quiet Christians in the world of, well, Judaism, but also in the greater world. Hopefully that background is helpful. None of it proves anything, but it does give us a little bit to work with. Two interesting options for the book of James and what it is. One of them I had heard before, and it is striking the commonality between the things that James says and the things that Jesus says on the Sermon on the Mount. I'm going to get to that, the theory behind that, in a minute, but let me just read for you some of those similarities so you get a sense about why people think this is a big deal. I'll read from James first, and then I'll read from Matthew following that, and you can just note for yourself the similarities. Speak and act as those who will be judged by a law that gives freedom. For judgment is merciless to the one who has shown no mercy, but mercy triumphs over judgment. Matthew, for if you forgive others their sins, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive others, your Father will not forgive you your sins. James, a spring does not pour out fresh water and bitter water from the same opening, does it? Can a fig tree produce olive trees or olives? My brothers and sisters, or a vine produce figs, neither can salt spring produce fresh water. Matthew, you will recognize them by their fruit. Grapes are not gathered from thorns, or figs from thistles, are they? In the same way, every good tree bears good fruit, and every bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree is not able to bear good fruit, nor a bad tree to bear good fruit. There's more to that. James says, and above all, my brothers and sisters, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no, so that you may not fall into judgment. Matthew says, but I say to you, do not take oaths at all, not by heaven because it is the throne of God, not by earth because it is his footstool, and not by Jerusalem because it is the city of the great king. Do not take an oath that is by your head because you are not able to make one hair white or black. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. There's a few other similarities. Note that there's a Sermon on the Mount option, that James and the Sermon on the Mount, they're collaborating in effect. Another interesting option, and this is one that is new to me, and this is where my Jewishness sets in. There is something called I don't know if it's Yalkut or Yalkut, but I'm going to say Kut, because I think that's probably right. But a Yalkut is this. It's a collection of highlighted teachings by a rabbi, often collected by his students. The main emphasis of a Yalkut is this, practical Torah, practical engagement on how to live, not philosophical, but concrete, instructional guides on how to live according to Torah. This was a very common practice when a rabbi had his students over a period of time would listen to their teaching, and I'll get to that in just a second, and then they would collect those thoughts in the form of a sermon. So you had these things traveling around that were collected thoughts of a rabbi that were written, prepared by his students, but the rabbi's thoughts. Further, it is interesting to note that if you were to compare James and you were to compare Leviticus 19 and a little bit of 20, you'd find a bunch of similarities, not unlike we found with the Sermon on the Mount and James. I don't think I'm going to go through and read them all. There's 8 or 9 of them, actually. The argument is that what the book of James is this Yalkut, this assimilation or a collection of teachings, but it's very specific to James's sermons in the synagogue, teaching specifically on Leviticus. Many of you probably know this, I would assume, but in the Jewish world, well, they say clear back then, and certainly throughout history and up until today, every week there's the weekly Torah reading. It's called the Parasha. And it's the same all over the world, in every single synagogue, in every single city, in every single place in the whole world. The same section of Torah is read on that particular day. And there is one particular section that is read called the, I'm not going to say this right, Parashat Kedoshim, which happens to be the section of Leviticus 19:1 through 20:27. That's the section of Leviticus that was read. That happens to be where we find a whole bunch of similarities between the book of James and that particular section of Torah reading. So the argument is that what happened was, on that particular Shabbat, Friday night, when the rabbi took the Torah, and if you've seen or been to those, you know what this is. He took the Torah out of the, well, I don't know if they have the little box like they do now, but took the Torah scroll out, and he read the section on Leviticus. That was that weekly reading. By the way, maybe you don't know how this actually went, but I'll tell you, I think, I'm being told, I wasn't ever there, but there was the weekly reading in Hebrew, which the rabbi obviously would have read. And then following the weekly reading in Hebrew, there was a paraphrase of sorts. It wasn't an exact translation or interpretation, but a paraphrase that was in Aramaic. A targum is what that's called. And that was because the majority of the people in the synagogues, although they were well-versed in Hebrew, there's differing opinions on how well-versed, but certainly they would have known some Hebrew. That's what they probably learned Torah in as young men. But they didn't speak, some say, on an everyday and regular basis in Hebrew. They spoke in Aramaic. So the rabbi would read in Hebrew, but not everybody completely understood that, the argument goes. So it would be followed by a targum, which was the paraphrase in Aramaic. Then the rabbi would give his sermon, as it were, his thoughts on what it was that that particular section of Torah meant. Now, I'm going to embellish a little bit, but I don't think it's a complete guess. When they left on Friday night, that wasn't the last time they were in the synagogue until the next week. They came back, some say every day, for lots of hours. My assumption is that what happened was is that the rabbi would speak to that particular section of Torah, he'd give his sermon, and then throughout the week, they'd come back and they'd debate and discuss and go over what it was that that section of Torah meant. That's what I actually think James is the record of, or those conversations, that discussion back and forth between the rabbi James and his students about how then shall we live in light of the section of Torah that was read. The argument breaks down a little bit. It's not completely everything that you find in James isn't 100% found in that section of Leviticus. But remember the string of pearls where you just sort of start talking and then it just sort of leads to this and to that and to that. It's not unexpected that a teacher of any sort would find himself talking about things that weren't directly related to the text at hand. I find myself doing that all the time, where I started talking about this and I found myself clear out over here. So I don't know. If you want to go with that with me, good for you. And if you don't, that's fine. I don't really think it's going to change what the letter means. But I think it does inform this. Whatever happened and exactly how that went down, this is review to most all of you, but I'll say it again. This, at a minimum, this is something written by a Jewish rabbi, we'll see in a minute, to Jewish people scattered all over the world, from a Jewish context in a particular time when to be a Jewish believer was a huge deal in that particular Jewish believer's life. There is little doubt that there were struggles and challenges and difficulties in being such a believer, but it is from the Jewish believer's perspective that this is written. It's not a Gentile writing to Gentiles. It's not a Jewish people writing to Gentiles. It's a Jewish rabbi writing to Jewish people. And I think I mentioned the last time, I get criticized for this all the time, to just get off your Jewish thing all the time. But it is Jewish. I mean, that's what it is. It's a Jewish letter written to Jewish people during Jewish times with just Jewish ideas and Jewish thoughts. So however it all went down, whether it was from Leviticus or Sermon on the Mount or whatever, this is really Jewish. And if we don't ask the questions that come up from this letter or this collection of writings, if we don't ask the question from a Jewish perspective and ask the question and get a Jewish answer, we miss. We miss. We might get the right answer, but we maybe won't get the right answer. I'll say this a whole bunch of times, I'm sure. One other thing that dawned on me as I was studying this, and then I'll get into the text itself, and I see I won't get super far, but I don't know why this, I never thought about this before, but it dawned on me that any time a New Testament writer, whether that be Paul or one of the apostles or arguably James or Jude, Peter, whenever they're making assertions about things, whenever they're sort of just talking about life in general, I don't know if I can say it's 100% of the time, but I think most all of it, maybe 100% of the time, it is with Torah in the background that they're making their comments. They're saying what they're saying because their entire lives were built around living by Torah. I mean, if you take the time to look at what Jesus said, I haven't done this to see exactly how many things are directly related to Torah, I'll bet you that most all of them, maybe all of it, is all with Torah in the background. This Jewish way of life, this Jewish way of thinking, is why they say what they say. So it is always the case, as students, that we should be looking at this stuff with Torah in our backgrounds. What is the author saying with respect to what Torah says about that thing? Which makes this difficult, because we have to not only try to dig into what the author is saying, but we also have to dig into what Torah is saying, which, as most of you know, is really hard work. There are ways to get at that. I'm incredibly unfamiliar with most of this, but not only can you read Torah, so the Old Testament, for those of you who aren't, that's what that is, but there are works out there that are helpful in understanding Torah. I won't go through all of them, but you've heard the words. There's Talmud, there's Mishnah, there's Gemara. There's a number of ways that we can get our heads around what it is that Torah means. But I just put out there that if we're not careful in remembering that the authors are thinking with Torah in their background, we're going to miss what it is they're trying to communicate. Okay, I was going to just skip, but I'm going to say one last thing before the text. James is a weird letter. All the other, well, for me anyway, everything I've studied, there's sort of an argument, there's a flow, there's a rhetorical style that I'm trying to get my head around. And for me, I don't know if I have a legal mind or not, but my head works pretty well around, okay, what's his argument? Why is he saying it? Why is he saying that, then, there, why, and how? That makes sense to me. There's a certain flow to it. Romans is certainly that way. Hebrew, all of them. I mean, pretty much all the letters, it seems to me. This one's not like that. At least I don't think it is. If it is, I've missed it. It doesn't seem to be an argument that you're trying to step back and say, what's the big question here that the author has? Who's he fighting with? It's not like that. It's way more just, again, this sort of series of thoughts, things that are important to know, things that we should all think about, things that we should consider as we're figuring out how to live our lives as believers and how to live our lives together. So it seems a bit disjointed to me. For example, it's hard to know where sections are. Like, where do we start and stop this section? And I'm used to that. Where's the chapter break, right? Where's the verses stop and start? So you're just going to have to bear with me a little bit with that. It's not obvious to me how this goes from a rhetorical perspective. I think there is some reason for what he says and why, but it's not quite like the rest of the letters that we've studied around here, at least that I'm familiar with. So I guess that's a warning in some respects. All right, we'll see how many of these verses we get through. Let me read the first 8. If we get that far, that will be great. I have done my own translation, by the way. That's no news around here. I've done it twice now on this one. I would love to hear Ron or Jack or David's perspective on this. They say that James is very eloquent and elegant Greek, which I don't know. I guess I don't know enough about Greek to know whether it is or it isn't, but it's not particularly complicated Greek. I don't find it super hard to get my head around the language in that particular letter, so why it is that it's elegant, I'm not sure. So I've done my own translation, and it's not that different from your New American Standard. I was reading the two together this week, and it's like, yeah, okay, well, it looks like you just changed a few words in the New American Standard. Jack said something a few weeks ago that I thought was interesting, because I find it true of me, too. It's amazing to me how often my translation looks like the New American Standard. Well, that's because I'm pretty familiar with the New American Standard, and the words that they've chosen are probably the words that I'm going to choose, too. So it's not that radical. I didn't provide a copy of the translation. I will try to note along the way if I think there's a word or a phrase that could be done a little bit better. I'll let you know. You can follow along in a New American Standard, and I don't think you'll be lost at all. But I have done the work, for what it's worth, of doing my own translation. So James 1 through 8. James, a bondservant of God and the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes in diaspora. Greetings. My brothers, consider it all joy whenever you become involved in various temptations, knowing that testing of your belief produces perseverance. But perseverance must have a finished work in order that you might be finished and complete, your telos not lacking in any way. But if any of you is deficient in wisdom, he should ask from God, the one giving to all generously and without revile, and it shall be given to him. But he must ask in belief, without discriminating, for the one discriminating is like the rough water of the sea, having been driven and tossed around by the wind. For that man must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all of his ways. Now we get to the more like a Bible study. The first verse is not particularly problematic. We've already discussed who we think the author is, James, the brother of Jesus, a bondservant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ. We're familiar with that terminology, a bondservant, a servant by choice. James is just saying nothing more, nothing less. He is a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ. I'd just like to note, whenever I bump into the Lord Jesus Christ, the first time I see it, I say it, his name isn't Jesus Christ. His name is Jesus the Messiah. So Christ is the title, not his last name. Everybody knows that, but I bring it up because it drives me nuts when people say it as though that's his actual name, Jesus the Messiah, or the Messiah Jesus. To the 12 tribes in diaspora, or diaspora, greetings. The only thing that I'll note there is, it is important, I think, to note that this is to the 12 tribes. This is a letter written to Jewish people, I think. There's a very odd argument that suggests that somehow that means the church that is spread around throughout the known world, the Gentile church. How they got there made absolutely no sense to me, so I dismiss it. And I'm going to go ahead and assert that this is a letter written to all of the Jews who, after the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, basically got booted out of Israel, or at least out of Jerusalem, but arguably out of all of Israel. And now they've settled all over the known world, and they've planted, as we know later on from Paul, and traveling around to all these places, there's these little communities of Jewish people, believing Jewish people, who are now trying to figure out what it means to be a believer in a Jewish and or Gentile world, not in Jerusalem. My brothers, he says in verse 2, consider it all joy when you become involved in various temptations. This is an interesting passage and not unfamiliar to any of you from what it means to consider it joy when you encounter various trials or temptations. I noted that the word that is used here for temptations, it's the same word that is used a number of times in the New Testament, but there are five interesting places at least that I note that this is the same word that's being used. The first is in the temptations of Jesus, when it says that Satan tempted Jesus, and then we have the three different temptations that we have. That's the same word we have here. The second one is in the Lord's Prayer. Our Father who art in heaven, blah, 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 lead us not into temptation. Same word. The third one is when Jesus is speaking to the three in the Garden of Gethsemane. You remember the story. He goes to them and he says, pray that you may not enter into temptation. Same word. The fourth, and this one I hadn't noticed before, it's the same temptation Jesus notes when he's telling the parable of the seed in the soils. And then the seed that goes into the rocky soil, it sprouts, and then the temptations of the world snuff it out. Same word. And the fifth, when Jesus says, I didn't write the reference here, I want to say this is the Mount of Transfiguration, you are the ones who have entered with me in my trials or my temptations. I don't know about you, but when I read this, consider it all joy, and I'm quoting my New American Standard, not even my own translation, but anyway, when you encounter various trials or temptations, don't you automatically think about things like stealing or lying or lust or adultery or all the bad things that we think of ourselves as being tempted to do? Those kinds of temptations. Well, notice it's none of that stuff, at least in the cases that I read and the five other uses of that word that Jesus encounters. I think that what James is referring to here is exactly the same sort of temptation that the passages that we just looked at where the word is being used to describe what Jesus is going through, I think that's what James has in mind. The same kind of thing that Jesus was facing into with temptations, which wasn't stealing, probably, and adultery, and lying, and disparaging somebody else. It was a whole different temptation that he was struggling with, or at least he was working through. I think that the synonym or the definition of temptation here is something along the lines of testing of your faith. that question that gets presented to us in exactly the same way that it did Jesus. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. What do you believe, or will you believe? So it is a temptation to simply stand up and walk away from what you have become convinced is the truth. Do you believe, or do you not believe? That is the question. That's the temptation or the trial. I got a little bit more specific with respect to what I believe in terms of what my faith actually is. Here's how I described it in the order in which the questions are asked, or the statements that I would make to which I would ask, is this true or not? God is the author of a grand story, the grandest story ever told. The story contains two sets of people, those who will receive eternal life and those who will not. There are at least two things anyone chosen for life must confront: the actual story of Jesus and all that it meant, yes or no, and is it up to God to shape those chosen for life in any way he chooses? Is he or is he not worthy of my absolute allegiance? Will I walk as a creature wherever the Creator directs, or won't I? That's the question of faith. When it says, consider all joy when you encounter various trials. When we bump into circumstances in life, and I'll get to some specifics in a minute, it is those sets of questions that I think James is referring to when he's saying, those are the kinds of things that you should be thankful when you run into in your life. Those questions about whether or not you are ultimately and actually going to believe all the things that you say you do about who God is and who you are and what you are going to do about it. It seems to me that there is a question out there, well, so what qualifies as one of those temptations? What is one of those things that would ask me that fundamental, ultimate question about my life and my faith? And my answer to that is, it's anything that we run into that asks me, are you going to believe what he says is true or aren't you? Those are the temptations and the trials that I think we have to ask ourselves. Are we willing to step into that, or are we unwilling to step into it? Those are the kinds of things that are the temptations. Those are the things that qualify. It is interesting that James says you consider it joy when you encounter those things. I was thinking about that, and I was actually going back and reading the way that Jesus approached temptations, whether it was in the Garden of Gethsemane or the temptations in the desert or whatever he was dealing with at the Mount of Transfiguration, all of those things, or even when he was reciting the Lord's Prayer. He didn't seem very joyful at all. There's no note of him being happy. There's no note of him being pleased. There's no note of him being thankful. And yet, James seems to think that it is a joyful thing for anyone to get stepped into those circumstances where these questions are elevated. What is he thinking? Why would that be joyful? And I don't know that he actually answers the question in the second verse, but he does in the third verse, which says, knowing that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. This is something we're all very familiar with. We've read it in Romans a number of times. And it is the reason why I think James can say that it is joyful, because even if Jesus were asked after the fact, considering what you know coming out of the temptation or the trial that you were faced, are you happy you went through it? And I don't have any way to prove this, but I think if Jesus were standing there, or if he were standing here and we asked him that question, he'd say, well, yeah, actually I am, because it's the only way I would have ever known if I believed or I didn't. Had I not been asked the question, in his case, are you going to go through with it or not, by Satan in the first place, and then whether in the Garden of Gethsemane, I don't know exactly how that interaction went, but Jesus could have never known whether or not he was a true believer, which sounds very odd to say, had he not gone through the temptation or the trial, that question, are you going to take God at his word or aren't you? And had he never been asked the question, he would have never been able to say, yeah, I am, and walked through that and persevered, knowing that the testing of your faith produces perseverance, because it is after you go through and have persevered that it is joyful. And we all know that. I haven't gone through very many really hard things in my life, a few, By the way, I should have said this at the beginning. Every now and then, I don't know why, I worked with kids for a number of years at a church as a sort of youth pastor. And during that time, for some reason, out of nowhere, I would cry. And I never cried before that, ever. But for some weird reason, all of a sudden, when I would be talking, something would strike me and I'd cry. Now it happens sometimes. I never know when it's coming. It's just, I don't know why. So if it happens, just bear with me. I'm fine. It'll be over in a short amount of time. It's usually when I think of these things in my life, and there's a few specifics where it's just like, oh my gosh, it just overwhelms me. Like it just about is right now. Just so you're just going to have to get over that and just bear with me, because it'll happen, I'm sure of it. But I do think back on those handful of times. And while I would never, ever, 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 ever choose to go through it, I can look past it now over my shoulder and with joy say I'm glad it happened. Only because I can say, standing here looking backward, I persevered for now. I think that's an important point, which we're going to get to, for now. I don't know what tomorrow brings, and I don't know how I'll respond to that, but for now, it is those temptations, those trials, in exactly the same way that I think Jesus walked out of that desert after Satan had tempted him with those three things, and he said, I know what I believe, and I know where I'm headed. And then he lived his life for 3 years, probably had a number of those other things that had occurred to him that were temptations. And out of the Garden of Gethsemane, when that last and final temptation came, he walked out of that garden and he knew. He knew what he believed and he knew why. This is the only way he could have done it. And he was joyful in that, joyful in knowing that he had persevered. I can relate to that. I can't relate to Jesus, but I can relate to that, that it is perseverance that is the reason for my joy in the temptations and the trials that I have endured. And I think that's exactly what James is referring to. We haven't got to it because we don't know yet, but if you're thinking about, well, what was James's audience thinking when they're reading this? Remember, this is Jewish people who are living in a world that didn't like them. We're going to get to some of the details later on, but I think life was super hard for them. I think life was incredibly hard for them. I think their lives were in danger. I think their property was at risk. I think their children were probably being persecuted. I think life sucked for a believer, a Jewish believer in a non-believing world. All sorts of things were coming at them, all measure of questions around, do you believe this or not? So I think James is speaking directly into a situation that they were in a very real way asking the question, do I or do I not move forward? And he's saying it is those questions that you should be thankful for. It is the very trial that you're enduring that you should delight in. Why? Because you can look over your shoulder and know you persevered. You know who you are based on what you've been through, knowing that testing of your faith produces perseverance. And maybe we'll finish on this one, verse 4. But perseverance, I really struggled with. This is the one translation work that I struggled with this week. But perseverance must have a finished work in order that you might be finished and complete. And then I have brackets around it. Your telos, not lacking in any way. That is one difference, I think, but I won't bother to get it out. New American Standard, the way that they translate it sounds to me like they're thinking that you are complete, in some way perfected, or something along those lines. I think the thing that is complete here is the telos, and we're going to talk about that to finish. You all have heard that word. You know what it means, probably from your time in the last couple of weeks when Jack was going through Hebrews. But it is that intended end, that completion, that which was intended to occur. So what he's saying is that this perseverance, the thing that I've just been talking about, must have a finished work. In other words, it's got to end up somewhere. It's got to continue. It's got to go on. It's got to repeat itself. Because at the end of the day, what it has to do is when it's all said and done, when you've walked through whatever life is and you're done with life now, the finished work is, as Paul writes it, I've run the good race. Finished. I've been tested again and again and again. And along the way, I've screwed it up any number of different ways. But I've always come back and I've always returned to answer the question in the same way I started. He is God. I am a creature and I will live my life according to his creativeness. I'm not in charge. That's the finished work. That's the telos, I think, that he speaks of. That final place where you can look over your shoulder one last time and say, I've persevered. I have not abandoned what I believe to be the truth about who God is, in order that you might be finished. And that's what I think finished is, utterly complete in your pursuit of what is true. Your telos, that process of finishing, in no way lacking. Nothing's been left out. You're done now. It's over. You've finished the good work. I note here two things and then I'll quit. This telos, as a result of my perseverance, happens over a lifetime. It is, in effect, my life's project. And the things that I do and say and think and invest in should be to that end, to the end that my belief is unwavering and resolute. And then lastly, I think it does seem to me that this is both how we respond to what life brings and to what we bring to our life. In other words, coming to that completed and finished work, in one respect, is responding rightly to what God is setting before us, in front of us, that we have to deal with. But in, I think, just as meaningful a way, it also is, what are we bringing to life? What are we investing in? What are we deciding matters? What are we pursuing with our time and energy and money and all those things that we hear about? What are we actually doing to complete our own telos? It isn't just us responding and reacting to anything and everything that God sets before us. We got to wake up in the morning and go do something. And while it's the mundane of life that we have to do, there are choices along the way that we're all making every day, all day, about what are we going to do to complete our telos? What are we going to make out of our lives in order that we be finished in the mind of God? There are a number of choices to make. We all do it every day. What do I do? Which I think is going to relate to what James is saying later on about works and faith, and we'll get there when that time comes. Okay, 5 minutes left, and I had four more verses to get through, and I obviously didn't get there. Any questions at all about that? Comments? Corrections, Susie? No?
I have a question about the dates. You said it was written about 60 A.D., but the Jerusalem fell in 70 A.D., so how does that work that he's writing to the Jews in diaspora when he wrote it in 60 and Jerusalem fell in 70?
I misspoke. He would have been writing to people prior to Jerusalem falling. You're right. They would have been scattered.
Already because of persecution?
And I'm trying to remember now when, there was some, I can't remember, there was an event that I was reading about just the other day that was one of those precursors. Obviously, Jerusalem hadn't been sacked yet, but that folks were scattered and pushed out of Jerusalem prior to that. But you're right, I misspoke. It wasn't anybody who had been shoved out after 70 AD. He hadn't got there yet. Thank you for noticing that.
And I was just remembering, I can't remember where it is, but I think it was Paul that talks about Jesus, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross. So we have that sense of whether it was the perseverance before the cross through everything, or even just his looking forward to his Father's pleasure with him. You know, there was some joy involved, even though he wasn't maybe happy all the time.
I don't know about you all, but I've puzzled over that. I mean, in some respects, I totally get it, the joy set before him. I mean, he knew where he was going and why, but nothing about that was joyful. Nothing about that. And that's, tough. Well, Mike is going back to Ron. I should have said before I started that I did look, and it was been about 10 years, I think, since you taught on James. So I thought two things might be true. One, most of these people wouldn't have heard it, and if they did, they forgot. And it's been such a long time, you forgot everything that you said.
Right.
So I'm hoping to instruct you along the
way. No, that's right. That is absolutely right. I don't remember a word I said.
Good.
All I was going to say is I had always thought that the likely people that he was writing to were those who had gone out into the dispersion because of the persecution that arose when Stephen was killed.
Thank you. That's the one I was looking for.
Right.
What he said. Yeah. That's what I meant to say. Thank you very much. That's exactly what I was trying to remember. Okay. We will plow through more next week. Oh, one up here.
What was the amount of time between him writing the book and being martyred?
Supposedly only about 18 months. Not very long at all. But remember, if the one theory is right, which I am inclined to think is legit, he didn't write it. So even if he was dead, the collection could have been gathered together post, what is it called? Post, thanks. I always want to say hummus. That's usually not right. So he didn't require that he be alive to actually distribute that collection. But it was about 18 months, they say, between when it was written and when he was martyred. Okay, thank you.